Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Kathy Stack, Advisor for Evidence-Based Innovation at the Office of Management and Budget. So, Kathy, as I was doing the research for our interview, I noticed there was a lot of initiatives happening, and one of them was Pay for Success, which is another approach to strengthen the use of evidence in government. Would you tell us more about the PFS model, or what I've come to know as the social impact bonds? How does this approach provide a viable alternative to funding?
So, especially at a time when government resources are so constrained, and we have, in many cases, fairly rigid rules about what dollars can be spent on, there are a lot of creative ideas out there for things that we could do on the prevention side in social services programs in particular, where if we had really effective prevention programs, it would improve the outcomes for individuals, and it would also avoid future government costs. Mm-hmm. For example, one of the areas that's getting a lot of attention and Pay for Success right now at the state level and the local level is recidivism. Okay. We have a number of efforts underway now in New York City, Massachusetts, and New York. Massachusetts and New York are just starting, where the government looked and did the analysis of their costs and realized the huge costs associated with having youth who have been incarcerated go back on the streets and get into trouble again and come back into prison. And the data tell you that that's unsustainable for government. The prison costs, or anytime there's institutionalization, there's huge costs to government. So there was a massive focus on, okay, what can we do in terms of giving the youth offenders the training, the mentoring, the wraparound services that they need so that when they come out of prison, they get on a good track and can become productive in terms of getting employment. So all of these proposals, and there are actually projects now underway, have created the business case and gotten the working capital from the private sector rather than the government to actually run these prevention services. So there's nonprofits and government agencies working together to try different strategies to keep kids out of jail. And there's very rigorous measurement methodologies and evaluation methodologies so that working to make sure that there's real comparison groups where we can. We're using random control trials or strong quasi-experiments. And the idea is that if we can show, or if these new projects can show, that they achieve results, well, the investors will be repaid based on the results. And so they're putting their money in. They're not going to see any return for a little while. But if they get the return, it's because the government has realized savings and they're sharing that back with the investors. And the individuals who are served are realizing improvements in their lives.
So, Kathy, I was wondering, how is the evaluation capacity being cultivated and built among federal agencies?
Evaluation capacity is very uneven right now. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to both maintain momentum and progress in the agencies where we have strong evaluation capacity, but also lift up the others that aren't. So, frankly, resources are very limited, and getting Congress to appropriate new funds for evaluation is a big challenge. We can't ask for those funds until we know we've got really strong agency capacity to use the funds well. Mm-hmm. So part of what we're doing is trying to get agencies to share those best practices and learn from each other. OMB is running a workshop series that we started in September that has had several sessions so far with great turnout. We've had to turn a lot of people away. Wow. Bringing agencies from all across government together. First workshop was focused on how do you create that evaluation capacity that's focused on high priority questions and challenges that are priorities for the administration. And we learned about agencies that have set up chief evaluation offices that report to the secretary, who help programs develop evaluation plans. We heard about different procurement strategies that some agencies use so that they can simplify the process of going out and doing task orders so that evaluations can be done much more quickly. We learned about set-asides. Some agencies have managed to get from Congress authority to set aside a percentage of funding that gets pooled in the policy offices and then can be deployed on high-profile, important evaluations. But the way they've gotten those set-asides is they've always been able to demonstrate to the appropriators that those dollars will be well spent. We're also trying to help agencies learn how to do evaluations more quickly and at lower cost. Mm-hmm. So there's a sort of traditional view of evaluations and rigorous random control trials taking a lot of time and very costly. Mm-hmm. And people just don't have the patience to wait for 5 years, and 5 years down the road there are going to be other problems to solve. Well, these days there's tremendous assets that are being untapped in terms of data, with lots of rich repositories and statistical agencies, administrative data sets at the federal and state level, where we can create evaluation designs to tap into those and produce evaluations much more quickly at lower cost with just as high quality.
So you have all these the performance data. You're collecting all the performance data. You're doing the rigorous evaluation. But unless you take all this information and all this knowledge and apply it to actually informing decision making, it's really a lost cause. So what are you doing to incentivize agency and agency leaders to use the evaluation knowledge that they collect?
Well, we're trying the carrot and the stick approach. And being at OMB, you have both. In the early years of the administration, when there was a lot of money sloshing in the system, I mean, frankly, money was falling out of the sky for the first year there, we decided that with a lot of the high-profile initiatives that the president was proposing in social services, that we would say to the agencies, hey, we'll make this bigger if we add in a really strong evaluation component, if we create like a tiered evidence design where we embed evaluation into those activities. So we were very focused on creating evidence-building capacity and dangling money out as a way to get the agencies engaged. When funding got tighter, mm-hmm. and we really had to start taking a hard look at ways that we could be cutting the budget, we recognized that agencies always want to have something new, something that they're building rather than just taking away. And so we said to agencies, hey, if you bring us strategies for expanding a program that you know works, or expanding a promising program where if we embed evaluation strategies into it, we're going to know whether going forward we're getting the value for our money. If you can bring us that and simultaneously help us understand where dollars are not being used well in your agency for low-priority programs, ineffective programs, we're going to be on your side. You're going to come out better in the end of the budget process. You might ever even get a little bit of an increase while other agencies are getting cut. So with some agencies, that worked very well, and it helped them see the light in terms of making some hard choices inside their agencies and shifting dollars to other things.
So when you think a layperson thinks of program evaluation, if they understand it a little bit, they might think it is that five-year, very complicated process. But you folks are talking about rapid, low-cost experiment designs that you're using. And more particularly, how is the administration and your efforts fostering a culture of rapid experimentation?
So, really interesting development last year. The Office of Science and Technology Policy brought in a woman named Maya Shankar, who came to explore whether or not we could set up a social and behavioral sciences team of experts who could be centrally located either somewhere in the White House and provide a service to agencies that didn't have evaluation capacity so that they could learn how to use this tool of rapid experimentation to improve their operations. She was successful in many respects in being able to capture the imagination of different agencies and offices, who many of whom had never been touched by evaluation. And one way she was able to do that, she succeeded in getting a number of agencies to detail expert evaluation staff to a team. And she also got top academic institutions to essentially loan at no cost some of their top faculty who could form teams to go out and provide assistance to agencies. So, just to give one example, the Treasury, Bureau of Fiscal Services, do debt collection, government-wide debt collection activities. I think probably since the early 1990s, they have relied on a letter that was drafted back then that goes out to delinquent borrowers to tell them their responsibilities in terms of repaying the debt. Well, the Bureau of Fiscal Service said, maybe we should take a look at this letter. And in the process, they said, hey, there's an opportunity here. We know it's a terrible letter, but we don't know what the best approach is in terms of what the right letter would be mm-hmm. that would get us the best results in terms of increasing collections. So they partnered with this new social and behavioral sciences team and said, let's create a multi-arm trial. Let's write four different letters, take our best understanding of what gets people's attentions, putting a clear signal up front in the letter why we're writing, get the attention so it doesn't land in the trash. But they did variations. And that letter, those variations of the letter, is now in a testing process in the course of less than 6 months. I think it may be 4 months. They will have substantial data on which of those letters is the best one, and that will be the one that they use going forward.
Well, what are you folks doing in the area of developing common standards for research and evaluation? Could you tell us a little bit about some examples where this is happening?
So common standards, it's funny, when we use the standards word, sure. It sometimes scares people because they're worried that they're going to be in a rigid straitjacket. So we're kind of softening the vocabulary and talking about common guidelines. But a lot of this work that I've seen started with agencies coming together voluntarily. They recognized that they had a problem. So first, the Education Department and the National Science Foundation, who had for years been working on STEM education programs to improve math and science. They had very different approaches to evaluation, and they were not compatible. So you could not aggregate the results and say, collectively, what are we learning? The Office of Science and Technology Policy, Carl Wieman at the early part of this administration, challenged those two agencies to come together and build a framework, build a set of common, which at the time we called standards, the two agencies could use to determine what interventions, which strategies were at what point in this evidence continuum. They spent about 2 years doing it, but in the course of that, they came up with a common understanding that when they went out and briefed the Department of Labor and the Department of Health and Human Services on the standards, those agencies said, this would work great for us as well. We don't have to reinvent something. So we've got those agencies, and now they're bringing in others who are thinking about, let's create a common vocabulary we can all use when we talk evidence and start creating comparability. What's also great is there's now outside foundations, academic institutions, nonprofits who are having parallel conversations, and we're exchanging our different like visuals and standards documents so that there's actually a lot of coalescence around the approaches. And then we also have, in the world of cost-benefit analysis, the Institute of Medicine and the National Academy of Sciences is looking at developing common standards for how we do benefit-cost analysis that would enable us to really aggregate different studies and create comparisons of which approaches are most cost effective. And many of the same people who are involved in the development of standards for the federal government are also involved in that.
There's a lot going on, and if I was an agency leader, I'd want to know what works. And I mean, sharing best practices is a great way to get buy-in. Could you tell us a little bit more about the research clearinghouses that have been created on what works?
Sure. So my favorite example that I know the best is the What Works Clearinghouse at the Education Department, which was started under the Bush administration. And prior to that, what we had was we had clearinghouses where anything that had been funded by the federal government landed in it. And there was good quality research and not so good quality research. And we left it to the public and to the academics in the field to try to navigate all that and understand what was useful there. The Bush administration was determined to try to bring research to bear in improving educational achievement, and they brought in Russ Whitehurst to run the Institute of Education Sciences. Russ said, we've got to reinvent this thing. We should start from scratch, create a clearinghouse. We'll call it the What Works Clearinghouse, and we will have very clear, rigorous standards for what is allowed to go into it. We want it to be very big and robust, but it's more important that we have good quality research determining what can make the cut. So they set out the standards for the first few years. The idea was that researchers would push in their research to be reviewed to see if it met the standards, it could land in the clearinghouse. And for the first few years, there was hardly anything in the clearinghouse because there had been so much poor quality research done in education for several decades. But by setting the standard, they then started to generate, they created demand for high quality studies. And it transformed the field. And education research today, compared to where it was a decade ago, is in a completely different place. And now many, many evaluations are going on, both federal and non-federal, that meet the clearinghouse standards. And so we are building a body of evidence on what works for math education, what works for reading, what works for teacher professional development. That same clearinghouse idea is taking off in other agencies. Some of them have had some clearinghouses of their own for a while, but the Department of Justice has Crime Solutions. Department of Labor has something called CLEAR, that is their new clearinghouse. HHS has a self-sufficiency clearinghouse in the Administration on Children and Families. SAMHSA and CDC at HHS also have clearinghouses.
What does the future hold for evidence-based evaluation within the federal government? We will ask Kathy Stack, Advisor for Evidence-Based Innovation within the Office of Management and Budget, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.